Welcome to Interviews with a Contrarian. I'm Mark Mielke, Executive Director at the Aristotle Foundation for Public Policy. The Aristotle Foundation is a new think tank, new Canadian think tank. We hope to launch early next year. Our issues will be reason, democracy, and civilization. There's a lot under those, I know, but we will begin to publish fact sheets and studies and other briefs on such matters and look at where Canada is going on such issues. One of the things I wanted to do, though, before we officially launch is give viewers and others a bit of a preview of some of the things we will do at the Aristotle Foundation once it's up and running officially. One of those is a series of regular interviews with people I call contrarians. And so the series is called Interviews with a Contrarian. And today I want to interview Andrew Lawton on his new book, The Freedom Convoy, The Inside Story of 3 Weeks That Shook the World. And I'm not sure if Andrew, welcome, and I'm not sure if contrarian is applicable or not, because your book ended up in the top of the bestseller list. And so I don't know if that makes you a contrarian anymore. You've gone mainstream, but welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I will happily shroud myself in contrarian robes for the purposes of our chat today.
Okay. Well, the book, well, this came out of your experience, obviously, as a reporter for True North. And I should mention that that's who you are. You're a senior journalist for True North. And you've been widely published at the National Post, the Washington Post, other media outlets. You've got, what, 10 or 15 years experience in journalism? And
I think you're giving me a little bit more generosity than I deserve there. I'll say 12 on the outside, but I did other things in the middle.
Okay. And this book, The Freedom Convoy, you wrote, obviously, after the Freedom Convoy earlier this year in the winter. So let's jump in a little bit about this. You start the book with a great story. And what occurred to me as I read through it is this is a bit, the Freedom Convoy seemed a bit like Woodstock for truckers. Am I right?
Yeah, and I've actually used that analogy myself when people have asked me about whether there could be another one and should be another one. And I think that, sure, you can try to capture the spirit of it here and there, but I think it is going to be like Woodstock in a way where there can only be one, because it was really the product of so many different things that all came together and so many people that all came together at one point.
So Woodstock is perhaps a good analogy because, you know, the bad and good from Woodstock, right? Conservatives used to hate Woodstock, at least those in the 1970s. But on the Freedom Convoy, I mean, you and I have chatted about this offline, online before. I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, in general, I think Canada's, our liberties have been infringed for a very long time. I'm not a fan of election time restrictions, for example, on advertising. I think there's been other problems with freedoms in Canada. And I don't think we have the proper balance in this country. On the other hand, when it came to the Freedom Convoy, I had mixed emotions. I'm actually kind of an agnostic in this sense. I didn't watch any of the video about the Freedom Convoy when it was happening. I read stories in the morning. I generally don't watch TV. I don't watch videos. It's just kind of a time management thing for me. So I'm someone who you could potentially persuade. So in general, I support freedom. I mean, who wouldn't in a Western liberal democracy? On the other hand, I was disappointed with the border blockades, because someone has criticized Indigenous protesters or environmental protesters who shut down projects and sometimes pipelines and the rest of it. I found those of us on what I call the small C conservative side of the spectrum, and I don't mean politics or partisan affiliations. I simply mean those who have this penchant for ordered societies and freedom and the rest of it within that context, I did find it disappointing that some were kind of threw away their brain or their analysis and said, yeah, the border blockades are fine. It was kind of a middle finger to the federal government and perhaps others. But we'll get into that a moment. Why don't I start with the basic question of why, what compelled you to write the book, other than the fact, obviously, you were there, but let's start there.
Well, I think it was because I was there that I saw there was such a divide between the mainstream media coverage, the traditional media coverage of the convoy, and what I was seeing on the ground. And I don't just mean when I take aim at that, I'm not just talking about media bias. I'm talking about, in some cases, just the literal nuts and bolts of what this thing was. And one of the things that the book does in a fair bit of length is talk about this network that emerged of operations hubs and command centers, these people that were working out of hotel ballrooms and doing all of these different things to fuel this protest and organize this protest. And you couldn't see that from the street level because all you'd see were the just the trucks. You'd see these trucks and these truckers on the streets. And I felt that there was a story there, and I was trying to get to the bottom of it myself to understand it. And really, I decided to write the book that I wanted to read because I didn't think there was anyone else that was as well positioned to write it as I was.
And there have been a number of books out since you published The Freedom Convoy. In fact, I noticed one where it's a coloring book as well. So this obviously has some popular, you know, there's a resonance here. The Freedom Convoy obviously has a resonance, and you're tapping into that. Where did this originate? I mean, again, assume that, you know, some of us have been living on Mars, or assume you're from another country and not intimately familiar with the origins of this. Was it Tamara Leach? Was it other people? Where did this actually originate? The very idea for the convoy, how did that start? Because you do go into a bit of detail in this, in the book, about prior events that might have been something that early organizers looked at and imitated, and were perhaps surprised by, you know, how big this became.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I should point out that one of the interesting things here is that there were people across Canada that didn't know each other that were coming to the same conclusion at the same time as each other, which is that they were fed up with the vaccine mandates. They were fed up with the COVID restrictions and all of these different things. And they wanted to do something about it. And a lot of them who were really doing their own thing came together throughout the course of this. But if I trace it back to, I think, that important spark, the really critical moment, it was a woman by the name of Bridget Belton, who's a cross-border trucker from Wallaceburg, Ontario, which is down in southwestern Ontario. She was unvaccinated. She was going back and forth across the Canada-US border without issue, exempt from quarantine and testing requirements as an essential worker. And she had this really, really bad run-in at the border one day. It was December of 2021. And what happened was she was going through and she was berated by the border guard for not wearing her mask. This is a woman who's sitting alone in her truck. And the upshot of it was that she was threatened with arrest if she didn't put on a mask. And she was told to drive her truck up and pull over and questioned and given the reprimand. And really, this was the culmination of a long period of growing frustration she had that in just a couple of weeks would change yet again when the government put in a vaccine mandate that would affect her and other unvaccinated cross-border truckers. And it was her taking her frustrations public on TikTok, of all places, where she had a connection that she forged with other people that were in a similar boat. And they just really came together. And it was her and Chris Barber, who was a fairly prominent member of the organizational team, that really worked together and bandied about this idea and eventually put it forward. And they ended up finding that things moved rather quickly, because what happened was they connected to other people. Tamara Leach came on board and she wanted to help out with fundraising and social media. And this idea in just a few weeks became what we now know as the Freedom Convoy.
How did Tamara Leach get involved? Because she's kind of the face of the convoy now and, you know, going through the courts as well.
Yeah. She got involved early on in this process because she saw that this thing was gaining steam, but it was really a disparate group of people. It was not a well-oiled machine. It was just word of mouth and TikTok videos and stuff like that. So what she decided to do was reach out to Chris Barber through a mutual contact they had and say, hey, I just want to help you raise some money. And the line that she gave is that she wanted to raise, I think it was like $20,000 to buy some truckers some sandwiches. That was it. The idea already existed at this time. And she had no idea when she joined that this was going to become like a $10 million operation that the convoy would raise. But her goal was to come in there and try to just manage the social media side. She's not a trucker. She's never pretended to be, but she thought that there was something here. And she did become, as many people know, the face of this, not just for supporters, but also for the state, which has, as we know in the story as it goes on, taken a very antagonistic view of the convoy.
Let's go into the origins again a bit and follow up on Barber and others. I mean, was this an anti-vaccination, obviously anti-mandate? But you note in your book that 10 to 20% of truckers were unvaccinated. Governments often overreach. It seems reasonable that you could exempt truckers who don't want to be vaccinated, given they're sitting in their cabs for most of the day. So let's back up a little bit. What led the Canadian and then U.S. governments to think, you know, after all this time, and especially as vaccines were available and a lot of the population was vaccinated, that all of a sudden they needed to mandate this for truckers? Do you have a sense of why the federal government in Canada did that and then the Biden administration in the United States?
So it's a tough one to answer. And the short version is, I don't know why, because it defies logic and it defies sense. If we're talking about risk, this was at a period when COVID was already in decline. It was becoming less of an issue. And if we're talking about groups that are affected by this, groups that really have a risk, truckers were not that group. I think some of the answer to your question lies in the fact that we were talking about here a group that was not specifically targeted, in the sense that it wasn't a rule that came up. It was, in fact, that truckers had been given an exemption from the existing rules. So it was the exemption came to an end, which I think is a difference that may not matter to people. But I think if you're talking about the legalities of it, it is significant because the government just decided no longer is anyone exempt from this. So I think the reason, though, goes down to the fact that the government was committing to a 100% vaccination rate goal. That was what they wanted. They had abandoned this idea that once we get to 70%, we have herd immunity, then 90%. They wanted everyone to be vaccinated, and they wanted to take away really any of the perks and benefits of society that come along with being unvaccinated. Because at the time, remember, the Liberal government was also putting forward a vaccine mandate for air travel and rail travel, a vaccine mandate to work in the civil service. And I think they really just didn't want it to be easy to not be vaccinated.
They certainly didn't want it to be easy to not be vaccinated. And look, I've had three shots. I'll probably get a fourth. I get a flu shot every year. In general terms, I'm very pro-vaccination. Now, maybe the federal government overstepped on this. That's an argument. But let's get into the issue of vaccines and vaccine mandates a little bit, because this is an issue I have with some on the right, conservatives who, I mean, there's been an anti-vaccination movement around for a very long time. But I mean, I think it gained some notoriety or perhaps or some extra influence around the world with a fake study done by Andrew Wakefield that linked vaccines to autism many, many decades ago. And then it was pulled from The Lancet where it was published. But nonetheless, I think this set off a kind of some consternation and some concerns about vaccines that were unwarranted. Now, I'm not directly linking that to the concern about vaccines more recently, but nonetheless, this has been in the atmosphere for a very long time. So can we really talk about the vaccine or vaccine mandates without asking our side, so to speak? Well, in what cases would you actually think a vaccine mandate should occur? And, you know, I mean, what are your views? Well, let's start with vaccines, Andrew. What are your views on vaccines in general?
Because I think that's very pro-vaccine, and I've always said as much. Truthfully, I got vaccinated in the United States earlier than most Canadians were vaccinated, because I had the opportunity to go down there for work, and I could get it on what was originally the 3-week interval. And I think in a lot of cases, I was told what a lot of Canadians were and people around the world, that this was the way that you were going to get normal back. And I don't know if I was ever so naive as to believe it in its entirety, but I didn't get vaccinated because I was expecting any benefit from it in a legal or political sense. I got vaccinated because I thought it was the right thing to do for my own health. And I would say that when you bring up the Wakefield study, which I think is completely fair ball here, it's interesting for me that opposition to vaccines was always, by my measure, something that was in the domain of the left. That was where I generally got most of the criticism from.
And fringe, right?
You'd get some, especially from, and I'm a Christian, but you'd get some from a lot of religious communities as well. People that have their objections to some aspects of vaccination for other reasons, but it was always the political left, the natural health group. And it's been interesting to see the convergence of a lot of these groups in the COVID era. I will say, though, that there are a lot of people that are very pro-vaccine in general that have significant issues with the COVID vaccine. And I find I've been interested in this in a lot of ways, because I do think that in some cases it's not an entirely, if I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, it makes sense in some ways, because this is a different type of vaccine and it uses mRNA technology. So it is different than the ones you got growing up. It's not as easy to say that they're all the same. But at the same time, I also feel like for a lot of people, they don't like how government has used this vaccine as a political wedge. And that's why I've never been comfortable with the arguments we hear from people that, well, you know, you need to get your measles, mumps, rubella shot for school. It's the same. It's no big deal, because we've never seen a vaccination as politicized as this one. Certainly not in my lifetime.
Well, so again, part of this is, I guess it comes down to the data, the science, and this is where all the arguments begin, right? And I've given up trying to keep up with the data and all the developments, right? I mean, early on, I read up on the vaccines like everyone else, tried to get a grasp on it and tried to get a grasp of the data worldwide on what was happening in various countries. And frankly, you know, it's a full-time job, which I don't have time to do. So part of it, in my response, has been, look, I mean, I found it curious, though, because I don't have the same skepticism of the mRNA. And frankly, I think, you know, most people that talk about it, you know, whether it's you or I, don't really have the time or expertise to get into it deeply. I mean, we can read and go, well, that's interesting, and make some, you know, basic, you know, conclusions about what we've read. But I think, honestly, I'd prefer to see, you know, people who have, you know, some deep knowledge of science and how vaccines are developed, and this in particular, debated if there's going to be a debate. But beyond that, what is your view, or, you know, and some of the people you encountered at the protest in Ottawa, do they see any room for mandates? And the reason I ask this question is because ultimately it's a question about whether, you know, in this particular case, governments made the right call, whether this was 1918 and the Spanish flu, because in that case, there were also mandates, so to speak, and they were necessary. So, do you think there are times where governments would be justified in that scenario of imposing mandates? Because a lot of the people I'm hearing on the right side of the spectrum take a freedom approach, which, again, you know, in general terms, I agree with. But I think there's exceptions to everything. So where do you come down on this? I mean, do you ever see a point where a government can say, listen, the reality here is this is a pandemic, and maybe everyone got it wrong this time, who was in government and the politicians and the health experts. But that aside for the moment on that argument, because again, I think that requires a lot more digging into the nature of this vaccine in particular. Do you think there's any time where government should be able to impose mandates when you're in a pandemic?
It's a difficult question, because I think that it's impossible to separate the sort of the test case of the Spanish flu, for example, from the COVID case, in which the science was not where it was for the Spanish flu, and the casualty count was not where it was for the Spanish flu, and the viral spread was not where it was. And if you are talking about COVID, I don't think people can look past their distrust in institutions. And that's where, in the COVID framework, I have a great deal of difficulty accepting that there was ever or could ever be a justification for vaccine mandates. Now, let's take this to a mythical future pandemic where...
Sorry, let me interject or question Andrew. So chicken and egg thing. I mean, did the fact that there were some really restrictions, and then the vaccines came along rather quickly compared to how most vaccines are developed in you know, in recent decades, isn't it a bit of a problem in the sense that, okay, could have we ended up in the Spanish flu situation is the argument, if the vaccines hadn't been developed quickly, if there wasn't some social distancing, the rest of it, or do we have to assume, or should we only assume, that things would have rolled out just as they did with or without vaccines? Because it seems to me the presence of the vaccines does make a difference to that argument, does it not?
Well, I mean, the demographic profile, I think, was the big difference there, and that the Spanish flu was going after people who are otherwise healthy, whereas COVID was going after people that had more comorbidities, people that were older. And that's not to say that their lives have less worth, not at all. It's just to say that this COVID followed what we expect the flu to do as far as who's most affected by it, where the Spanish flu didn't. And it's about, and I think that was what for a lot of people really brought around the question of making protection of the vulnerable the first priority versus taking this one size fits all approach. But you're asking me a question that is a perfectly legitimate question that I feel like is also a trap at the same way. Do I think a mandate is ever acceptable? Because if I say no, then I am committing myself to an ideological position that could take lives. And if I say yes, then I'm accepting that it's just a question of degrees. And I think that at a certain point, it comes down to, is there a very clear and direct scientific benefit, clear and direct scientific benefit that will protect other people's lives, not just the person affected by the mandate's life? And I think that part is very key, because I do believe that people have the right to make their own reckless decisions, and people have the right to put themselves in harm's way. And even the most fire-breathing libertarian, and I consider myself a moderately fire-breathing libertarian, but even the most fire-breathing libertarians would say you don't have the right to harm others. So that becomes the critical question of are you protecting others from it? And for the vaccination, I think this is where the discussion gets very important. The COVID vaccine is not protecting people from getting it from others. It's not protecting you from giving it to others. It's supposed to be linked to your personal outcome and your likelihood of ending up in a hospital and your likelihood of ending up dead. So I think once it became clear that the vaccine was not reducing transmission, certainly not in the way that it was told it would, that became, I think, the biggest criteria against a mandate.
Okay. And I'm not actually attempting to trap you, Andrew.
No, and I don't. Again, it was a legitimate question, but it's a really difficult one for people that do believe, as I do and as you do, in freedom.
Yeah, and it is a difficult question. Well, it's also that, again, where are the exceptions? If I just hear someone repeat something, not you in particular, but I mean a freedom narrative, which again, in general, I agree with, but they're not thinking of any exceptions, it makes me wonder if they would ever think of exceptions. And the example I've given to people when they've pushed back on me, or I've gotten emails saying, well, why haven't you written on this? Well, for a number of reasons. One, time. Two, I'm setting up a think tank. And three, when it comes to some of these issues or freedom issues in general, John Stuart Mill's harm principle, which you referenced obliquely. So for me, I said to one person who wrote me, I said, look, whether you agree with what's been done in this particular instance or not, I asked them the same question as you. Is there an instance where you can agree with the government restricting your freedoms based on John Stuart Mill's harm principle? And the clear example is property rights, right? My neighbor doesn't get to poison her land because it would seep into mine. So again, all of this, of course, comes back to the data and the science and whether you agree the right judgment calls were made early on in this and later on. I do find it curious, though, that some were so skeptical of the vaccine, and I do want to get back to the Freedom Convoy, but I think this is an important discussion to have as well. I do find it curious. Daniel Smith, now running for the United Conservative Party leadership in Alberta, on her talk radio show before she jumped out of that and into politics, back into politics, was endorsing Invermectin and yet skeptical of the vaccine. And the company that produces Invermectin said, look, this is not for COVID. It's in tests for that, but it's not for COVID. We can't guarantee it'll work. We can't guarantee anything. And yet, people who are skeptical of the vaccines seem to be glomming on to Invermectin, which I thought was curious. Your take on that?
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned this. So I've had this idea that I've wanted to write about, and I haven't been able to answer the question sufficiently enough that I feel competent writing about it. But I've wondered how people that are very skeptical of big pharma in some sense are also very supportive of other creations of big pharma, you know, ivermectin by Merck, and hydroxychloroquine was the other one that came up early on. And I think one of the challenges, because I asked a couple of people I know that are very pro ivermectin and very skeptical of COVID vaccines. I said, how do you justify this? How do you rationalize this? And they said, well, we're not against pharmaceuticals. There was a familiarity that they liked. They say, well, I know ivermectin. I'm familiar with this. I know it. And someone that they trust has told them about this. And it's very difficult because I've avoided, which for someone who in the last 2 years has covered COVID mandates extensively, I've avoided covering a lot of the science very deliberately because I'm not a scientist. And, you know, I like you, rely on what the quote unquote experts. And I realize that word has been weaponized, but
well, but you suspend judgment, right? You have to suspend judgment because they can't be an expert in everything, right?
Yeah.
And so there's all sorts of ins and outs you're not going to be aware of unless you're an expert in that field. And frankly, I've been trained in that field.
Yeah, and that's the challenge here, is that there are experts to say both things. And, you know, one side may have more quote-unquote experts than the other, but I can find someone in a white lab coat that will say the COVID vaccine will save lives, and I can find someone in a white lab coat that says the COVID vaccine is dangerous. I can find someone in a white lab coat that says ivermectin is a great treatment for COVID, and I can find someone in a white lab coat that says no. And I'm not taking a relativist view here that there's no such thing as truth, but what I am saying is that people have to decide which version they're going to trust. And that's been one of the big challenges here, is that there has been this belief that there's been this belief that truth is so subjective, and this belief that science is subjective, and this belief by both sides that the science has been weaponized against their side. And I don't know how you break through that, because on one hand, you have people saying, trust the science, trust the doctors, but they're the first ones to silence other doctors that go against the main narrative. And we've seen this in climate science. We've seen it in medicine.
It's a problem not to do with just COVID and the development of this drug, but it's kind of a problem of social media in general today. Or how do you get to the actual facts that matter, right? I mean, I've got some experience in tax policy, so I can tell you which tax statistics matter and which ones don't, or why averages are a problem and that sort of thing. But I've got some familiarity with that area, you know, having read a lot of dry, boring tax statistics over the last 25 years and government documents on the same. So I can spot when someone's using the statistics in a wrong way, sometimes deliberately or sometimes accidentally. But again, we're back to the problem. We're not experts. None of us is an expert in everything, right? So you got to figure out, you know, what's going on in terms of the data you're looking at or the science. One last sort of observation, and then let's head back to some of the Freedom Convoy's developments. I did find it curious again that some libertarians or conservatives who normally don't like government regulation and for years or decades have been saying, you know, part of the problem with healthcare in this country is there's too much regulation. In terms of the development of drugs in particular, I remember David Graetzer, a Winnipeg author, now Toronto, 20 years ago wrote a book on the healthcare sector in Canada. And I think his statistic at the time was that it costs $1 billion to develop a pharmaceutical drug. And then all of a sudden, this time, it was developed in a hurry at the request of governments. And we had people on the right, almost conspiratorial about it was developed too quickly, or all of a sudden suspicious of the free market, or at least the market getting to a product to you in a hurry. All of a sudden, they were deadly scared of COVID vaccines, even though they've been developed in the way that they've been asking, you know, governments to back off on and let them be developed for decades. So I found that curious as well. All of a sudden, there was a lot of libertarians who were scared of the market doing its thing and delivering something to you in a hurry when they were asked to do so. I don't know if you noticed that contradiction as well.
Yeah, but I don't know if it was a contradiction necessarily. I mean, there was an aspect of the concern that I saw, which I think is entirely legitimate, which is that these companies were given liability waivers by government because of the haste with which these things were developed. And
would you develop a drug in a hurry without that liability? I wouldn't. If a federal government came to me and said,
perhaps,
develop a drug
but
in a hurry.
But who loses out then? It's the person who is injured by the vaccine. And even if you are a pro-vaccination person, you have to accept that there are risks of injuries and deaths. And we've seen in the UK in particular with AstraZeneca, a number of people that were killed or injured by the vaccine. And the government has started paying out, I think, like, you know, 100,000, 150,000 pound claims or payments from this vaccine injury program. In Canada, we've had, I mean, I think at least one person, I don't know if it's been more than the one person that's been paid out, but people don't like that aspect of it. But if I go back to what I think your question is getting at, people that decide they're against something are going to find the most logical arguments they can use to oppose that thing. And people who are for it are going to find the strongest arguments for it. I mean, if you are decidedly against the COVID vaccine, you will cling to the fact that, oh, well, it's only been given emergency authorization. It's not been given full approval. When this is a distinction or an argument that really doesn't matter to you all that much in any other circumstance, I'd suspect. But if you're pro-vaccination, I think you tend to discount a lot of other people's stories if they come against what you believe. And I look at this in the context of people that have dealt with vaccine injuries and people who have lost loved ones to the vaccine. And a lot of these stories of people that have been completely erased, the mainstream media is not writing about them. Twitter is censoring their accounts because it's supposedly misinformation, even if it's not. And I think that there is a tribal mentality on this issue that is not at all rooted in science on either side. And I don't like the direction of the discourse there.
Well, it's part of human nature, I think, isn't it? That's always been a problem. So confirmation bias, but then also, again, I think it's a bit ironic or contradictory. Again, on the right side of the spectrum for a very long time, conservatives have not liked the precautionary principle when environmentalists overuse it, right? So again, it's a bit of a judgment call. All right, we're going to develop something that's not perfect. If we waited for perfect, we'd have no vaccines, which maybe someone would prefer, but we'd also have no industrial development, right? I mean, it's been an argument of deep greens for a very long time that you can't do X, Y, or Z because it may do something to the environment, as opposed to, yes, but can we get 95% of the way there and clean up 95% of the problems? And there will be some, 5% negative effect on the environment. So it's funny. Again, I think what COVID has done, and Donald Trump did the same thing in politics, but COVID to sort of philosophical arguments or positions and ideological positions, there's no easy distinction anymore. I mean, as you observed a moment ago, anti-vaccination folk used to be mainly on the left, and now there's some of on the right or a faith variety that seem to have taken that position as well, for right or wrong. But let's jump back to the book, The Freedom Convoy, The Inside Story of 3 Weeks That Shook the World. I'm talking with Andrew Lawton, senior journalist at True North. So Andrew, let's jump back to some of the GoFundMe issues and some of the politicians that showed up. But let's start with the GoFundMe issues that developed in the midst of this convoy, or at the beginning. There were a lot of donations that came in. How did the money get handled? And I mean, this became a pretext later on for GoFundMe to shut down the account, and then also for the federal government to freeze bank accounts when they invoked the Emergencies Act. What did happen with the GoFundMe funds? What's the status of that now?
So the GoFundMe was one of the first hurdles that the convoy organizers really had, like a structural hurdle. So what had happened was the city of Ottawa and perhaps the federal government and provincial government in Canada and Ontario, we don't know, had lobbied GoFundMe to have the fundraising campaign completely axed. And GoFundMe initially put a freeze. They had released $1 million to Mayor Leach, the first million that had gone through the due diligence, and they did it to buy fuel. And TD actually froze that money under its fraud prevention measures somehow, and because they said they hadn't traced the origin. So the convoy organizers had pulled out like $36,000 of that first million, and the rest was frozen. And then the GoFundMe campaign kept raising money and eventually got up to a little over $10 million. And then GoFundMe completely suspended it. They said they had evidence that it was being used for an illegal occupation. And they originally said you could request a refund, but they were going to donate it to another charity. And then eventually they said, okay, we'll give everyone a refund. So convoy organizers then pivoted to another fundraising campaign, this time on a platform that was more ideologically aligned with them, called Give, Send, Go. They raised in a fraction of the time essentially the same amount of money, a little over $10 million. And then what happened is the Ontario government got a court order making it illegal to do anything with that money, to have it, to spend it, to transfer it. So they effectively locked that money outside of Canada. And while they were trying to figure out a way through it, the Emergencies Act came in, and all of a sudden the bank accounts were being frozen by the government. So very little money from online donations actually made its way to the convoy. It was just that first $36,000. But moreover, later on, they pivoted to just cash. People were showing up in Ottawa with large amounts of cash, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, and they were donating it. And they were doing this in a way that completely circumvented any attempts to regulate what was happening. And the stories that I tell in the book about this really tell the overall theme that money wasn't the source of the convoy's momentum. It was a reflection of it. And I think that a lot of the government thought that if they go after the money, the whole thing goes away, but that really didn't work out that way.
This again is connected to a very Canadian, or at least recent Canadian predilection, which is, you know, politicians are often scared of populist movements, right? When Preston Manning started the Reform Party in the 1980s, I mean, he was called every name in the book, right? Including far right, including Nazi and the rest of it. And this seems to be a problem in Canada where, I mean, look, the Freedom Convoy, to me, again, I agree with, you know, the general, you know, presumption of freedom. I think it's an important, healthy presumption to have. Disagree with border blockades, acoutes, and the rest of it, which we can get into. But nonetheless, it does seem in Canada, there are not a lot of ways to express yourself. And at election times, a third party is not allowed to advertise to the same degree as political parties. I mean, they can spend a tiny fraction of what political parties can do. If you want to run for the leadership of a political party in this country now, in most provinces and certainly federally, there's a limit on what you can spend, if I recall the details correctly. This seems to favor the insiders, right? And frankly, to the detriment of quality in politics, quality debate, quality people, right? And leadership candidates are drawn from a very narrow range of people already involved in politics, perhaps with name recognition. So this seems to be a very Canadian problem where politicians are afraid of populism. I think, you know, to a degree they should not be. And also, there's really no way to protest half the time. I mean, this isn't France. I mean, to me, the most amazing thing about the Freedom Convoy was that it showed up in Ottawa. I mean, this happens in Paris all the time. Occasionally happens in London. You get protests, you know, Washington, D.C. But those are fairly central locations for those countries, vis-a-vis Canada. Really, Ottawa's in the middle of nowhere, comparatively, you know, compared to Toronto and certainly Vancouver and Calgary or St. John's. So isn't this part of the core problem in Canada, is that people agree or disagree with elements of what happened in February in vaccines or vaccine mandates? The core problem to me is a lack of the ability to protest without being hammered down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also think that, I mean, when we talk about the double standards between left-wing and right-wing protests, and I use that, I'm oversimplifying, but you know what I mean?
It's there.
I think one of the challenges is that we don't yet have an answer to the question of what the limits of peaceful protest are. And the reason I bring that up as so important is that anytime people on the right did criticize rail blockades or road obstructions of any kind that take place at protests, we've always been told, well, protest is supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. Protest is supposed to be disruptive. Protest is supposed to make you feel powerless if you're sitting in your car and you can't drive through, because that's the way the people protesting feel. And there was a tweet by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that was circulating throughout the time of the convoy where she was talking about some other protests months earlier, but she said, yeah, this is meant to make things difficult for people. And the flip side of that is that a lot of the people that defended Indigenous protests that blockade infrastructure and labor protests that are disruptive were saying, well, the convoy is different. And they couldn't articulate why it's different. I mean, Jagmeet Singh was asked, you're the party of protest, why are you against this one? And he gave an answer that was basically, well, I don't like what they're protesting, if I put a crude paraphrase on it. So I do think that if there's one enduring thing that I would like to come out of the convoy, it needs to be, what is the limit of protest? At what point have you crossed that line? Because once you take the road or the border blockades out of the equation, which did cause, I mean, statistics have not shown an economic disruption significantly because people were able to use other crossings, but we know that they were very disruptive. If you take those out of the equation, trucks on streets in downtown Ottawa, the city of Ottawa was able to get around it. People were able to walk through, people were able to go to work if they wanted to. I don't think that was a protest that was really all that disruptive in the grand scheme of things, and especially after you take the honking out of the equation, which...
Well, but can you take the border blockades and the honking out of the equation? I mean, that's part of it. If I'm in downtown Ottawa or anywhere, and someone's honking all day long, especially an air horn, I'm going to lose it. So, and I'm sure that there was some, and yet you and Rupa Subramanya point out, listen, you walk around, most of these people are peaceful. How long did the honking go on for? I mean, was it overnight as well? I didn't watch the videos, but certainly heard the narrative from, you know, the traditional media on that, but and saw your point and Rupa's point, which I think are fair points, but was there not some disruption of people's daily lives that would irritate you if you had a big truck outside your home or your neighborhood that was using an air horn?
Yeah, there was. And I think there are two things though. The injunction was secured relatively early on. And in my book, all of the organizers that I spoke to said they were secretly happy when they lost the court fight over that injunction because they were tired of the honking too. So it actually gave them an excuse to go around and say, hey guys, we have to stop honking. And
the guy in the truck beside them is annoying them when they're trying to sleep.
Yeah. So I don't believe anyone was ever charged for breaking the injunction. I think that actually did deal with it. And there were a couple of isolated points during the day, but I think everyone was generally fine with that. It was much. I mean, I was there for the first weekend initially, and yeah, the honking would go and then you get to sleep, and then there's like just one honk that just wakes you up an hour later or something. And, you know, phantom honks, you just keep hearing them for days and days. So it was disruptive. But I think there was a disorder that a lot of people mistook for malice, and that these truckers, they had a loose plan of, yeah, we want to go to Ottawa and we want to stop there and protest mandates. But it was not a stage managed or choreographed operation. A lot of the trucks that ended up on residential streets ended up there because there was nowhere for them to go. The city had filled up. And they were trying throughout the course of the protest to get them off the streets and onto downtown Ottawa. And there was a critical point where they had actually negotiated with the city of Ottawa that they were going to move all the trucks onto downtown Wellington Street. And anyone that didn't fit on Wellington would leave Ottawa and go to one of these areas they had outside the city limits. And that was a protest that would have, I think, dealt with two key things. Number one, it would have taken the pressure off of the everyone but the federal government, because there are no residential streets or businesses on Wellington Street. And the other side is it would have made this a federal government protest, and it would have not been as disruptive to people in Ottawa. And it was telling that just as that thing was in motion, just as that plan was in the works, the Emergencies Act came in.
Let's talk about that. The Emergencies Act, I mean, harkens back to the War Measures Act that Pierre Trudeau invoked. But there was a very different circumstance in play in Quebec in 1971, when the Emergencies Act was invoked. You had the FLQ, you had kidnapped diplomats, and you had a murdered diplomat, or cabinet minister. So tell us a little bit about why the Emergencies Act, why you think the federal government decided to invoke it, and what was the pretext for that? I mean, did the truckers and others in the Freedom Convoy unintentionally provide, not justification, it's too strong of a word, but an excuse for using the Emergencies Act, which I think was a vast overreach?
I think that the government wanted the outcome. They wanted the Emergencies Act, and it was abundantly clear that the window was closing. So the border blockades, which really provided the government the pretext for it, had already been cleared up through regular policing powers or were about to be. Then this was Coutts, Alberta, Emerson, Manitoba, Sarnia, and Windsor, Ontario. These were cleared up with regular policing powers. The other aspect was this operation that I just mentioned in downtown Ottawa, where this protest was about to become a lot more concentrated and less disruptive to Ottawa residents. So there was a critical moment where if the government had waited even an extra day, I think Canadians would have seen there was no emergency. There was zero justification, whereas the government still had a little bit of an ability to pretend that things were worse than they were. So then you get to the question of why did Trudeau want it so much? I think the financial powers were absolutely key, because whether you like it or not, this thing proved that it could raise $10 million in a week. And that was money devoted to people that resonated in some way with what the truckers were protesting. Maybe it was opposition to Trudeau. Maybe it was opposition to vaccine mandates. And that money could have gone somewhere. It could have gone to some sort of political cause. It could have gone to any number of things. And I'm not talking about violent conspiracies. I'm talking about perhaps advertising, perhaps keeping this protest going for months and months and months with convoy organizers said they wanted to do.
Have you talked with Preston Manning about this? About his theory of why the government used the Emergencies Act? Yeah. So you will know his views, but for the sake of those watching, I mean, and I think this is public now, he said it at a conference, but his theory is that the federal government invoked the Emergencies Act, not because they were worried about Alberta truckers, but there was a populist element to this, a very large populist element among the truckers from Quebec and Ontario. And the government did, the federal government did not, which gets a lot of support in Quebec, did not want to see a populist movement arising out of Quebec in opposition to them. And thus they invoked the Emergencies Act result. I mean, that's Manning's theory. But let's also jump from Manning to another comment by Manning about populist movements, because I think it matters here. When he was founding the Reform Party, of course, there were all sorts of people that would attach themselves to the Reform Party. And you don't have time to vet them all, especially in a pre-social media age. We do the opposite these days. You get canceled for everything. But, in the 1980s, 1990s, with the Reform Party in play, Manning said, "A bright light attracts many bugs." Now, there was some of that with the Freedom Convoy, where they were attempting to keep out the kooks and the KKKers, so to speak, insofar as they existed and came around. Can you tell us a little bit about that, especially early on, where they tried to really say, look, this is going to be about truckers, about a protest. And you note the multicultural, multi-ethnic, element of the truckers' protest. I mean, a lot of truckers today are, East Indian in ethnic origin, right? Or Southeast Asian, to use a more modern term. And you had left-wingers and hippies and pro-choice activists who, again, didn't like the mandates. But so you had a pretty interesting rainbow of people, protesting and showing up at the Freedom Convoy. Nonetheless, you also had some problems, not you, but you note this in the Freedom Convoy, that the Freedom Convoy had some people show up that some in the traditional media took as representative of the truckers.
Yeah, and if I can just jump on the challenges of the populist uprising for a moment, these groups that you mentioned, and there were more of them, were often disparate groups that normally would never have anything to do with each other. And the convoy brought them together. And I think in the gestalt of it, this was greater than the sum of its parts. You had Quebec separatists and Alberta separatists that were joining forces for something. You had Indigenous activists and, white suburban Ontarians that were joining forces. You had people from Alberta and people from BC and people from Ontario and the East Coast and Quebec. And they were all coming together here. And that's very dangerous, because if you have a group that has, 100 people in one province, then a group that has 50 people somewhere else, and this is not likely to do anything to upset the balance of power. If you have all of these coming together and saying, well, actually, we're united. I mean, we have a system where you can get a majority government with 40% of the voters in a country. So this relies on the remaining 60% being far more fragmented than they could be. And I think the convoy did threaten that. And I think that's why, if I agree with you, and I do, that Justin Trudeau was so bothered by this. So to go into some of those groups, there was a real diversity here. And I'm not saying that it was a huge diversity of opinion, because obviously everyone agreed with the core idea that vaccine mandates were wrong and that they embraced that idea of freedom. But a lot of them came for different reasons. And that was the one thing that was interesting to see. I met people that said, yeah, I'm fully vaccinated, but I'm against the vaccine mandate. Or people that said, I'm fully vaccinated, but I really don't like this vilification of the unvaccinated, because I have people in my family that are not comfortable with the vaccine. And you had people that say, I don't care about this COVID thing at all. Just, I'm fine. Yeah, restrictions, lockdowns, mandates, fine. But I didn't get to have a funeral for my father, for my mother. And all of these people who came to this issue in their own way saw that they could have a community together. And I think that was the real risk here. And that was why the government had to concoct this emergency. And even some of the people I've met, like you, that are skeptical of some of the aims of the Freedom Convoy, understood that there was something about the emergency and the creation of the emergency that either was a complete farce or at the very least was a lot trickier. And especially to bring it around to where you started there, with the fact that organizers were very aware that we're not about overthrowing the government. Anyone who wants that, get out. We're not about radicalism or racism. Anyone who wants that, get out. And you can't control a grassroots movement, but you can say, this is who we are. And that's what they did.
Yeah, it actually reminds me a little bit of the origins of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, who I used to work for in the 1990s. When I came along, it had already been established, but its origins are actually in protests over the GST in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And it occurred to me, these are the ironies of history, you know, or these developments much later on, that the GST was actually good policy. It replaced a very bad export tax that punished Canadian exports. But the moment you get into the weeds and have to explain, as they say in politics or policy, you're dead, at least in politics. But it occurred to me many years later, here I was at an organization arguing that the GST made a lot of sense, but that organization was founded in opposition to the GST, or at least out of the protest movements. And there's something about the Freedom Convoy that strikes me as very similar. There are distinctions that I draw and have drawn, as you do. I don't agree with the border blockades and all the rest of it. And I think we should, you know, treat border blockades, you know, the same way we do for Indigenous protesters or environmental protesters. We shouldn't keep saying Indigenous protesters. Most of them, a lot of Indigenous folk are in favor of pipelines.
Yeah, that's true.
As you and I well know. But, you know, some of the more radical environmental protests that want to shut down everything should be treated the same way and vice versa when it comes to border blockades. It's an issue of commerce and the ability of one to get to one's job. And so on and so forth. Nonetheless, digression aside, I do think about the Freedom Convoy in that sense, where it obviously tapped into a great frustration. And you're right from various, and you write about this in the Freedom Convoy very eloquently, that it tapped into various groups who and people who just said, look, I have an issue here more generally with you know, what they saw going on and the missed funerals and so forth. Let's jump though a bit to the fallout in our remaining 7 minutes. The fallout in Canada and internationally. I mean, there was a domestic fallout in a political party. And then tell me about what you observed insofar as you looked at the coverage around the world.
I mean, the subtitle of the book has been one of the more contentious aspects. Now, part of that is because some people don't read the book. So all they have to go on is the title, The Freedom Convoy, and the subtitle, The Inside Story of 3 Weeks That Shook the World. But I think it did shake the world. And I say that because a lot of the coverage that we were getting of this thing that Canadians were really finding they resonated with was coming from foreign outlets like Fox News or GB News in the UK, Sky News in Australia, and yes, RT from Russia, which I don't hold up as a bastion of journalistic integrity, but they were covering it. And you know, people can draw from that whatever conclusions they want. But there was, for people around the world, something that they saw in this that they resonated with too, because Canada did not, for all that I have many issues with Canada's COVID situation and the handling of it by governments, Canada did not have anywhere near the most restrictive regimes in the world. You had places like Ireland where they put in place a radius that you could go from your home and no further than that. You had in England people not even able to sit on a park bench. You had Australia turned in for some people to an open air prison, even if you were vaccinated, because people just were not allowed to leave and travel. So this is not to discount restrictions in Canada that are very real for people, like a vaccine mandate for air travel, or which does, you know, effectively hamper people's ability to leave. But Canada was, for most of the pandemic, not as bad as some other places. So people in these other countries, I think, saw this trucker uprising in Canada and said, yeah, I can get behind that. I can do that. And there was a real interest. I was getting messages from people I know in the US where I used to do a lot of work that have like never once cared about anything I've covered before in Canada that were like, yeah, I love your work on the convoy.
Well, you know, the old joke about Canada from, what was it? I think it was, might have been the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, unless I've got the wrong Secretary of State. But, you know, the old joke about the headline about Canada, what is it that, you know, the usual headline about Canada is interesting policy initiative from Canada. I mean, that's, you know, which of course is deadly boring. I mean, Canada normally doesn't make waves around the world. So this was an exception to that rule. What do you think the long-term consequences, both bad and good, are of the Freedom Convoy for Canadians and around the world?
The one elephant in the room with the convoy is that the one thing they wanted, or the one thing they started out wanting, they didn't get. The vaccine mandate for cross-border truckers is still in effect to this day. And even a lot of the other mandates federally, like the mandate for air travel or for working in the public sector, remained in place for months after the convoy. They were only lifted in June. And there were certainly political changes. I mean, Aaron O'Toole's ousting, I think, was an effect of the convoy, because the conservative leadership race that followed has been one that's very much had candidates standing up against mandates, which the conservatives weren't doing before. You had other things that have come up as well, like provinces loosened their restrictions, and whether they did it because of the convoy or not remains contested. But I think that the bigger win has been in revealing what the government is prepared to do to stop people that stand up for freedom or stand up for anything. And this was really distressing. The Emergencies Act is not a chapter in history that we should look fondly upon. And I don't know what's going to happen in the several legal challenges afoot. I don't know what's going to come of the public inquiry. I tend to take a very pessimistic view of the Canadian judiciary. So I'm not expecting this to be the thing that crumbles the house of cards that is the Trudeau government. But I do think that Canadians will look back on this and realize maybe not that they agreed with the truckers, but that by the end of it, the government had surrendered the moral high ground entirely, if it ever had it.
It does, again, draw a distinction between Canada and how we do things and other countries, doesn't it? I mean, I think about the January 6th hearings and Lynn Cheney in particular, right, who's one of the few Republicans on that committee. I mean, my view of that in January 6th is, you know, I think Donald Trump was an agent of chaos and narcissistic. And I don't know that he planned this. I don't think he did. But I think it was entirely predictable, given where he'd been on his false claim the election was stolen. Nonetheless, what's interesting about the United States, whether it's Watergate, whether it's January the 6th or something else, of course, there's politics involved in these committees, but they're pretty openly aired. And, you know, and I've seen that time and again. I mean, judiciary hearings, you know, the same thing where, you know, you see the question of the potential nominee or the nominee rather. And we don't seem to have that same openness in Canada. I wonder if that's part of the frustration that leads to things like the truckers' convoy. Freedom Convoy is precisely a game because, look, I mean, you and I hang around people that make policy. We've both met politicians. I worked for one briefly, you know, helped write an election platform. I've been involved in policy circles for some time. You get to be on TV. You get to write columns. So do I. But that's not the experience of most Canadians. So I'm not surprised at the frustration. Because we don't seem to have a very open ability to openly debate these things. Like you and I just talked about some issues where we may disagree. But we certainly, you know, at the political level, we don't see a lot of open hearings investigating this, where again, of course, politics is going to intrude. Is that again part of the problem in Canada where, you know, there is this control freak tendency of governments, and it doesn't matter actually whether they're liberal or conservative or, you know, New Democratic at the provincial level, there does seem to be this control freak tendency where politicians are a little too afraid of the people that vote for them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that there's a reliance that government had, if we just bring this back to the COVID situation for a moment, that it would always have the final say on truth. And I think there was early on, this was the vaunted Team Canada approach that, you know, we weren't going to see conservatives and liberals and NDPers bickering about things because they'd all be on Canada's side and Canadians would agree with that. And back when, you know, the science with a capital S was this unvarnished truth that no one could or would dare challenge, that didn't last. And I think there's a reason that didn't last. I think we need to find ways that, especially the longer COVID went on beyond 2 weeks, to debate about what the best policy response is and what the science is saying and how to interpret the data and all of that. And I think that Canadians looked at that. And like I mentioned earlier, on their own schedule, on their own timeline, they all sort of came to a bit of a different belief about how much they could trust these institutions and how much they could trust governments and how much they could trust politicians. And remember, there was a time when Justin Trudeau was the unifying face that would come out before Canadians 7 days a week from Rideau Cottage and tell us what was up, and people set aside their partisanship. And when that no longer was the case and government realized, you know, we have to fight to keep people on board and we have to make our case, they started to get increasingly controlling about it. And all of a sudden, just saying, get vaccinated, it's the right thing, was an increasing vaccination rates. And then you have mandates. And all of these things that at one point were dismissed as conspiracy theory. Like, remember, I remember a time distinctly when booster shots were a conspiracy theory, when people were saying, well, you know, we're all going to have to get boosted again and again. And everyone said, no, that's crazy. That's not going to happen. And now the government is literally moving its definition of fully vaccinated to one that is revolving around up-to-date vaccination. So, I mean, all of this has been discussed at length, but I think it's all connected here in that politicians no longer were able to hold the confidence of the people. And they've been trying to mask that and manipulate that as best as they can.
Let's leave it there. Thank you, Andrew Lawton, author of The Freedom Convoy, the inside story of 3 weeks that shook the world. It is published by Sutherland House. You can buy it at on Amazon.ca. You can buy it at Chapters, although apparently it's not in the stores. We didn't have time to get into that today. Perhaps a future conversation on why that happened. And of course, your local bookstore. I'm Mark Mielke with the Aristotle Foundation for Public Policy. You've been listening to the latest installment of Interviews with a Contrarian. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.